From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, actress Sally Field confesses she's not very good at telling jokes, even though the character she plays gets pretty good at it in the new film Punchline. She and Tom Hanks co-star as two stand-up comics looking for their big breaks. Also today, Eric Kraft talks about his continuing series of autobiographies of the fictional character Peter LeRoy. In the latest installment, LeRoy discovers his grandparents had a secret occupation, making erotic jewelry. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs and Question Mark and the Mysterians, two 60s rock bands who drew on their Tex-Mex heritage. And book critic John Leonard reviews Bluebell, the new detective novel from Andrew Vox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Punchline is a new movie about aspiring stand-up comics. My guest, Sally Field, stars with Tom Hanks. Sally Field began her acting career starring in the TV sitcoms Gidget and The Flying Nun. It took a while for her to be taken seriously as a film actress, but her work has been rewarded with two Academy Awards for her roles as a union organizer in Norma Rae and as a widow struggling to hold her family and her farm together in Places in the Heart. Field starred opposite Paul Newman in Absence of Malice and opposite Burt Reynolds in Smokey and the Bandit, Hooper, and The End. In Punchline, Sally Field plays Lila Kritzik, a suburban housewife and mother with a new interest, stand-up comedy. For several weeks, she's been leaving her husband and children in the evenings to try out her material at a Manhattan comedy club. But she's uncomfortable on stage, and her jokes get no laughs. The best comic working this club is played by Tom Hanks. She wants some advice, and he decides to give it to her. In this scene, they are on the train, as Hanks explains that good comedy is more than jokes. The funniest material comes from your real life. It has to be personal.
What if it isn't funny? You tell me to talk about my life, but what if my life isn't funny?
All of our lives are funny, babe.
How about your kids?
Three girls.
Okay, all right. Big, little, what? Nursery school, babysitters, maybe?
Oh, God, they're going to need one if I'm not home by four.
All right, that's funny. Go with
that. There's nothing funny in that, nothing. The maid will leave and then the two little ones will be there all by themselves.
You have to think the comedy. Who's the babysitter?
Oh, just this kid that lives
comedy.
Down the street. I don't
comedy.
Think I brought
comedy.
His number.
What's the babysitter's name?
I don't know. It's just
comedy.
This nice kid.
What's the babysitter's name?
Charlie Manson.
All right. That's funny.
That's funny?
You just wrote a joke, yes. Yes, Charlie Manson, the babysitter? Yes, that's funny. Keep going with it. Go, go, go.
Honey, he's put X's on their foreheads again.
Sally Field, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Your character in Punchline, Lila Kritzik, she starts off as a bad, inexperienced comic and turns into a pretty good one. Were you tutored in how to be bad in addition to how to be good? Let's start with how to be bad.
No, I was not tutored at all. I just had a natural talent at being really awful. No, that was really easy. The hard part, of course, came in that my character's supposed to improve and be believable that she's on her way to being not bad. That's the hard part.
So did you go around to comedy clubs and start playing them, testing out the material you had to do for the movie?
Well, I wish I could say that, yes, I did. I was in every club every night of the week. The problem was is that I couldn't find the material. Both Tom Hanks and myself, Tom is in the movie as well, we both wrote our own stand-up with our own individual comedy teams that we had. And Tom, which says a lot about his character and person and mine, was out doing it every night. He had the comedy, he was honing it and crafting it and pushing it and pulling it and making it perfect, and I couldn't find my piece of stand-up until we shot it, which was at the very end of the film. So I worked on it about 6 months. Not that I was slow or anything, but it was hard.
What was so hard about it?
It's very hard to find. Comedy is a very personal thing, and it has to come from a person's life and a person's vision of the world. And it's very hard to do that and create that for a person that you don't know. I was doing it for a person that didn't exist, Lila. Now, I use that as an excuse. Probably if I had to do it for myself, I couldn't do it, which is the truth. I mean, I realized that, and I think I knew that before, but oh well. You know, doing stand-up takes a certain gift, and you can't really learn that gift. You can try to tap into the places in yourself that you find your own humor, But that doesn't mean that your gifts will ever, be the same as, say, Robin Williams or Roseanne Barr. You just can't make it happen just by asking it to. I think that in the film, Lila pulls it off. But Sally Field will never be up there again, you know what I mean?
Are there lines that you're especially happy with that you wrote?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wrote most of the stand-up at the end that you see. Most of that is mine. So when I hear an audience laugh at it, I kind of titter inside myself. Oh, gosh, that was funny. That's pleasing. That's really pleasing.
Well, I want to play a clip that we have from Punchline, and this isn't from the last performance that you're talking about, but this is from the first time that you, as Lila Kritzik, goes to a club and actually does good, actually, like, does material that comes from her life and that makes the audience laugh. And here's a clip with Sally Field as Lila Kritzik from the new film Punchline.
It's going to be career night because everybody's life is funny. Trust me on this. We are all God's little animated cartoons. This gentleman right here, sir, what's your name?
Murray.
Murray, trust me on this. When your life is funny, Murray, what do you do for a living?
I'm an insurance salesman.
You're an insurance salesman? Did you ever want to be anything else? Come on, think back. Think back with me. You're 4, you're 3, you're 2, you're a small child. You're dressing up. It's Halloween. You know, all the other boys, they're firemen, they're policemen, they're Zorro, they're Batman. And cute little Murray, whose mother adores him, is a...
an insurance salesman.
An insurance salesman? Murray, this can't be true. What, you dressed up in a polyester suit and you handed out cards with your name on it?
Was that part of the stuff that you wrote yourself, Sally Field?
Actually, that stuff, that's part of the comedy montage, we call it, where the Tom Hanks character, who's very good at what he does, takes the Lila character to various clubs one night and won't allow her to use any of her old stupid jokes that don't work and just forces her to talk to the audience. So this is like when she's trying to learn what it's like just to talk to people and find the comedy in the air or from them and relating it to herself. And when we did that, we showed 3 different clubs. When we did that, most of it was improvised. We had various lines that we had found from my comedy team that we know we were going towards, but most of it was just made up on the spot. A lot of Hanks was in there, a lot of Tom standing around saying, why don't you say that? You know, oh, okay, that's good, we'll do that. So it's just flying by the seat of your pants.
It sounds like the relationship between you and Hanks offstage was not unlike how it was in the movie, since he coaches you so much in the film.
You know, I don't think we saw that at the time because we were so involved in making it work. But now as Tom and I are going around and talking about the film, we sort of realize it's exactly what it was. I will never be as adroit as he is at it. And so he was constantly saying, oh, that's funny, do that. No, don't put that in there. Do this, da-da-da. So I was really Lila to him.
So are you better at telling jokes now than you were before?
No. I'm a terrible joke teller. I can never remember the punchline. My buildup is all wrong. I did the movie because I love what it's about. And I took it on. I'm one of the producers of the project, so we took it into development. And I don't think I ever really looked at it as an actor till we were about ready to do the film. And I went, oh my gosh, I've got to do this stand-up. I saw it more as a producer and being about this arena, which I think is so fascinating.
For the 2 roles that you got Academy Awards for, your roles in Places in the Heart and Norma Rae, you played Southern women. In this role, in Punchline, you play a New Jersey housewife who's testing out her comedy act. She's from suburban New Jersey, and your clothes are very interesting in it. The coat that you wear is this long plaid coat with a fake fur, I'm not sure which, trimmed collar, and you have these big tortoiseshell square-shaped glasses, and I was wondering who chose the clothes and the glasses. Was it you, or did you have costume designer for that?
No, actually, I chose all the clothes for Lila. I just felt that she looked this sort of unusual way. I don't know that everyone agreed with me all down the line, but they said, okay, if you feel this adamant about it. I just felt that Lila was not, a real trendsetter here, and I didn't think she was a woman that was able to go buy a new coat every year at Bloomingdale's. I don't think every woman is, or even was the kind of woman that looked through the various magazines that tell us what we should look like every year. I think she's a person that got a comfortable coat 10 years ago. It looked good to her. It had a nice little fur collar, and she said, hey, I like my coat. And then I think that when she got to the club and wanted to be funny, I think she thought clothes would help. And she never really was with it enough to know that wasn't it. That her clothes did not look like the rest of the gang. And I don't know, felt it was sort of the character in this kind of feeble attempt constantly at being somebody else until the end when she just wears a nice simple black dress and just is herself. She's constantly trying to be somebody else. And as you know, you can't make it when you're trying to be somebody else.
My guest is Sally Field, who stars in the new film Punchline. As you mentioned before, your company co-produced this movie. Mm-hmm. When you saw the script, why did you want to make it and star in it?
Well, when I saw the script, I wanted to make it because I loved what it's about the sort of bittersweet world of performing, centered around stand-up. I loved the relationship between, or the potential of the relationship between Lila and Stephen, and that the need that performers have for each other. Now, that wasn't really there when I read the script, but we knew that we could turn that into that. And I loved the Stephen Gold character, which was there, Tom Hanks' character, which I think is a fascinating look at a kind of performer, how this need to perform manifests itself on two separate people. In Lila's case, in a sort of healthy way, it fulfills her life and makes her joyous. And in Stephen's way, it's like a fix, and he's at an empty pit, and the more he gets, the more he needs. And it's a curious thing that the need to perform does to you.
When you're co-producing a film, you're the boss in a way. Did you feel like you were in an unusual relationship with the actors who you were working with because it was your company that was behind the movie?
I don't think so. I mean, I certainly never wore that as some sort of badge coming in. I was when we were on the set, I was an actor just like everybody else, and I mean, I had certain responsibilities that I didn't talk about on the set. I mean, I would talk over with the director or something or discuss certain things, but I never wore it around like, hey, look at me, guys. Tom would talk to me about it a lot because he, too, has a development company and is curious about, you know, how difficult is it when you're acting and all the things that actors are doing now. And he was asking one actor who has done it twice now about... how do you do it? So it's as long as you don't, like, you know, wear it around as if it means anything except that you're doing more work, basically. I think it works out fine.
I'm always interested to see if new films are running into problems with audience testing. Did you get into any problems with that yourself with this film?
Well, we used a lot of audience testing. We had to because it's stand-up, and you can't do stand-up in an editing room, and you just don't know what works. And it's very delicate because it's actually a drama. This picture is actually a drama about comedy. So you have to know how much drama to blend with the comedy, and do they understand what's happening, or is it getting confusing, and is the comedy funny? And I must say that the testing was invaluable to what was funny and what was believed and understanding what the film was about. It was, we tested quite a lot.
As a producer, do you think that you would cast yourself in roles that others wouldn't necessarily think of you for?
Oh, probably.
Is there such a thing as a Sally Fields role now?
I don't really know. I'm sure there is such a thing to some people in my industry. And thank goodness I'm not in a place now that if I don't think it's a role that I want to do, I don't do it. So I don't like to get pigeonholed, you know. If they think it's a Sally Field role, it's something I wouldn't do in a million years.
Well, obviously it's important for you to produce movies. I mean, I assume that's why you're doing it. So do you feel like you have a better crack at the roles you want if you're producing the movie yourself?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think it's just a matter of having a better crack at the roles that you want. It really is a matter of creating projects that you want to be a part of.
Making sure these movies get made in the first place.
Yeah. you know, the Lila character is not the most colorful character I've ever done, but the film is a really wonderful film, and it's something I'm very proud of being a part of. And I assume that the film would have gotten made someday had I not taken it on. But it had been around for about 10 years, so I have to in some way like pat myself on the back and say, you know, it got made because I said, yes, I want to make this movie. And the projects are just not around unless you find them or develop them or turn the town upside down and shake it and find these projects and see that they get done.
My guest is Sally Field, and she's starring in the new film Punchline with Tom Hanks, and they both play aspiring stand-up comics. Sally Field won 2 Academy Awards for her roles in Places in the Heart and Norma Rae. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Sally Field is my guest, who stars in the new film Punchline. I'd like to talk with you about a couple of your previous roles. I thought maybe I'd play a clip from Places in the Heart, a role for which you won an Academy Award, and you played a widow in Texas in 1935 during the Depression, and you're trying to save the farm, which might have to be sold because you're broke and you owe money. So John Malkovich plays a blind man who's living with you. Danny Glover plays a man who was begging until you took him in and gave him a job on the farm. And in this scene, you're suggesting that they all try to do the impossible, which is to harvest cotton very quickly to try to win this cash award that's offered for the first harvested cotton crop.
Right.
You got 30 acres to pin.
Frank and Possum can help.
Well, that's not going to be nearly enough.
Then I'll pick 24 hours
a day. Did you ever pick cotton before? After about an hour, the hull start to cut your fingers. Then by noon, both your hands are bleeding. But later on, your fingers start to swell. And after a little more time, there ain't no feeling left in your hands whatsoever. And I ain't even speaking about what it does to your knees. And I ain't even talking about what it does to your back. Now, we can't do it. Now, get that through your head once and for all. We can't do it. Now, you best stop thinking about it before you end up killing yourself.
Now, you listen to me. If we lose this place, then you're going back to begging for every single meal. And Mr. Wheeler, they're going to put you in the state home. And I'm going to lose what's left of my family. I'm not going to let that happen. I don't care what it takes. I don't care if it kills me. I don't care if it kills you. I'm not going to give up. And if the two of you do, you can go straight to hell.
I think a lot of viewers have probably started to think of you as Southern because of your role in Places in the Heart and in Norma Rae. Do you have any Southern connections?
Actually, I do have a strong Southern connection. I was raised by this sort of wonderful group of women that are my mother's relatives, my grandmother and all my grandmother's sisters, and they were all from the South. My grandmother was born in Alabama and raised in she was born in Alabama, and she moved to South Carolina and then moved to Texas. And my mother was born in Texas, so they were all very much Southern women, and that was my influence as a child. Even though I was born in California, they raised me, and I had a sort of Southern accent when I was a kid just because I heard it all the time. So I know that these women were certainly extremely influential in my life as to the kinds of women that they were.
When you went up to receive your Academy Award for Places in the Heart, you said, sounding surprised, to the audience, "You like me." Was it hard for you to feel that you were respected in your field after the TV series that you started off with, the Gidget and the Flying Nun series?
Well, I'm sure that it was and has been in the past, but I think that my particular response to that was just, you know, flat out the sort of enormous feeling you get when either you're getting a standing ovation and you've just given a performance, or your peers, you realize that your peers have voted for you on such an important thing. It, as ridiculous as it sounds, it's an overwhelming feeling of, oh my gosh. And also there was a red light flashing and I had you know, 2 seconds to say what was really in my heart or just BS everybody. So I just said what the bottom line feeling was, is this sort of overwhelming a feeling of affection and gratitude, and letting the people know how deeply it means to you, to any performer who gets that, whether it be a standing ovation for a particular performance or getting an Oscar. Nothing feels the same to a performer.
Mm-hmm. TV audiences were first introduced to you in the role of Gidget. Now, I was wondering, you know, her personality as this pert, lovable teenager. Were you a teenager at all in that mode?
Oh, yeah. I got Gidget because I was Gidget on one level. I mean, there was another dark level to me that stayed hidden, that came out in later work. But the level of me that was the easiest to present to people was the Gidget side of myself. You know, the all-American, giggling little thing, little American girl. And I always was that. I fit into that mold so easily as a young woman growing up in 1964 and the late 1950s. It was someplace for me to feel that I was fine. You know, I fit. It was when Sandra Dee was the number one box office female star, and I seemed to be a place for me to live, as far as I knew, and all the other colors seemed to be totally unacceptable. So Gidget was very easy for me.
Then from Gidget, you played the Flying Nun, which I understand that you first turned down and then accepted.
Who wouldn't? I turned it down. I know that there are people in this country who like it. I don't mean to say that they're... anything wrong with them, but I didn't like it, and I did it primarily because I was frightened.
That you'd sink without a trace.
Yeah, that I would. I had several people around me at the time who said, "Do it, do it. This is all you've got." And I think I was too frightened at the time to reach out for my dreams, like Lila does, and getting back to Punchline. But you know, and that's what it's about. To have the courage to reach out for your dreams. When I was 19 years old and I had done my first television series, I didn't have the guts. I thought I had the talent, and I certainly had the desire to act, but I didn't have the guts to walk away from television and say, go to New York and study and live in a small apartment and do off Broadway, which I think somewhere was my dream, but I was frightened. I was frightened to leave. I'd never been out of California. I'd never been on an airplane, and I was really unsophisticated.
Well, you did something pretty gutsy shortly after The Flying Nun. If I understand this correctly, you fired your agent and your business manager after The Flying Nun, and I was wondering what the last straw was that made you dump them and find other people.
I think it was this the third television series I did called A Girl With Something Extra, which, you see, you don't even know about. So.
That's right.
It had nothing extra whatsoever, except it was, I think, the last straw. It was the final kicker where I said, you know what, I've got nowhere to go except down. So why not just go for the things you want to be? What are you waiting for? And I think that was, I mean, it wasn't like one day I woke up and stretched and said, ah, yes, go for those things. I mean, it was gradual, but it, you know, these things, it started to build. It took years and years of it sort of eating away at me and burning a hole in my pocket until I realized I had to make a move. I had to go point myself in a different direction.
What was your strategy for doing that?
I don't think I had any strategy at all. I think I was simply going on just sheer instinct. I don't think I had it worked out. I don't think I was really sure as to what feelings were going on inside of me. I was angry at myself and all sorts of things. I had two children. I was supporting the children. I was scared. You know, these things. And having children... you know, as people know, it changes your life. And I had two little children, and I think I just felt if I was capable of taking care of them, then I was capable of taking care of myself. And I think I felt I had to get out and fight for them. And I think that probably propelled me forward.
I think of it as being Sybil. I think of Sybil as being the role that really turned your career around. You got to play a multiple personality.
Mm-hmm.
And that was plenty of opportunities for great acting and something like that.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly my opportunity to really do what I had trained and worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so hard to do. I got a break before that, which really got me in to read for Sybil, which was in this little Bob Rafelson film called Stay Hungry with Jeff Bridges and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
That, I think that was my industry kind of break, even though the public didn't see it. And then I got to do Sybil, and I think things started to turn. But it's all very gradual. I don't, you know, still it was a, you know, it was a long time before Norma came along. And it's a long time of just, you know, having to be very certain that you're going to make it, that you've got it.
You just said a couple of minutes ago that children change your life, as we all know. Now, I believe you had another child just a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. 9 months ago, actually. And I know that he's changing my life and my perception of myself as we speak. It's just that I don't know quite what, I don't have any into it yet. You know, I can't look back and say, ah, yes, this is how it changed me. I don't know. I know it's changing me a lot. I just don't know what it is it's doing.
Can I ask a perhaps stupid question? You were in your early 40s, I think, when you had your baby, your mm-hmm. your third child.
Yes, and I still am in my early 40s.
Right, yes. I was wondering if you were concerned at all during your pregnancy or shortly afterwards about what effects the pregnancy would have on your body, because I know how conscious you have to be of your body and yeah. of how you look when you're an actress.
Well, actually, I didn't think of that a whole lot. I mean, there's a side of me that said, what are you doing? You worked so long on those abs, honey. You know, don't let them, like, fall apart like this. And then the other side of me said, who cares? You know, who cares about those things? Because, you know, a child is so much more important than you know, your stomach muscles. And also, you underestimate what a miracle the human body is. Because even at 41 and 3/4 here, my body is coming back together. I've hardly even worked out. I think it all has to do with where women are now. You know, we are much healthier than our mothers were at this age. And goodness knows we have worked out much more than they probably ever did in their lives as a general rule. You know, there's some women, I'm sure, who worked out a lot. And I think that our bodies, even at 41, are able to just sort of bounce right back if you pay attention to them.
I have one last question. Punchline is about to open. Are you going to read the reviews, or will you let somebody else do that?
That's an interesting question. I let somebody else do that. I do. I've learned throughout the years that even if it's a good review, there might be one little line or something that someone puts in there that isn't even about the film that an actor, and I am one of them, will cling to. Something that you will hurt yourself with that's destructive. I you know, something could be about my stomach muscles. Who knows? Something ridiculous or something not ridiculous that isn't important to hear. But I honestly believe, and they'll get me for this, most critics in this country have no notion as to what they're critiquing. They're really just saying whether they like the film or not, and then they talk out of turn about a lot of things that isn't what a critic should be doing. Hmm. So there you have it, critics all over the country.
Well, Sally Field, I thank you very much for talking with us about your new movie and about some of your life as well. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Sally Field, and she co-stars with Tom Hanks in the new film Punchline, which she also co-produced. She and Tom Hanks both play aspiring stand-up comics. Punchline opens this weekend in a few cities and then opens nationally on October 7th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with singer, songwriter, and actor Tom Waits. He's featured in the movies Down by Law, Rumblefish, Ironweed, The Cotton Club, and in a new performance film called The Big Time. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Eric Kraft was a college student, he fell asleep in the library one day. When he awoke, he had the idea for Peter LeRoy, a serial novel about suburban life. Kraft's characters are back in Herb and Lorna, the story of LeRoy's grandparents and their secret occupation, making erotic jewelry. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the bands that brought us Woolly Bully and 96 Tears, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, and Question Mark and the Mysterians. And book critic John Leonard reviews Bluebell, Andrew Vox's detective novel set amid the sleazy world of the sex trades. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. House Senate conferees have approved by a vote of 26-8 a compromise plan to overhaul the nation's welfare system. The measure contains a provision requiring welfare parents with children under 3 years old to enroll in state education, job training, and job placement programs. The provision is the first federal work program for welfare recipients. New York Senator Daniel Moynihan, architect of the welfare reform legislation, said the House and Senate could vote on the measure as early as Friday. Both presidential candidates combed the Midwest for votes today. In Peoria, Illinois, Democrat Michael Dukakis attacked George Bush's stand on agricultural issues. Dukakis charged the Reagan-Bush administration with the loss of 200,000 family farms and 500,000 farm-related jobs. George Bush ended his campaign day with a riverboat ride into Owensburg, Kentucky. NPR's Jim Engel was there.
A cheering crowd of several hundred welcomed the vice president as he made his third campaign appearance today. He did not mention here his proposal earlier today for a new savings plan called an Individual Savings Account, or ISA. It would allow individuals to put $1,000 a year in the plan, and the interest would accumulate tax-free until withdrawn. And it can be withdrawn after 5 years. But economists say the actual benefit in dollar terms is small. After 5 years, for instance, the new ISA would yield only $25 more than many savings accounts. Reporters on the boat this afternoon asked the vice president about the plan, but unsuccessfully.
Can you tell us how this savings account plan you have...
Thank you very much.
Saved by the horn. I'm Jim Engel with the Bush campaign in Owensboro, Kentucky.
Despite some reservations, President Reagan today signed a $10.5 billion appropriation bill for the Interior Department. Reagan said the bill was the latest case of congressional overspending and brought the nation closer to triggering the budget-cutting provisions of the Graham-Rudman Act. The measure was almost $700 million more than the Reagan administration requested. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee today approved treaties with six nations, including Mexico and the Bahamas, calling for cooperation in narcotics prosecutions and other criminal matters. The treaties are designed to help U.S. and foreign officials exchange evidence to support criminal prosecutions. North Carolina conservative Jesse Helms unsuccessfully tried to block the agreements with Mexico and the Bahamas because, he said, many senior officials in those countries are involved in the drug trade. The treaties now move to the full Senate for action. A six-story apartment house collapsed today and slid down a mountainside in the northern Mexico city of Monterrey. Officials say at least two people were killed in the collapse and others have been trapped in the debris. Officials say the severe rains brought by Hurricane Gilbert 11 days ago could have had something to do with the collapse of that three-year-old building. The Polish parliament today approved by a vote of 338-35. Politburo member Mieczysław Rakowski is the country's prime minister. Before the vote, communist leader Wojciech Jaruzelski appeared before the parliament to confirm his party's full support for the new prime minister. Jane Dobia reports from Warsaw.
The first secretary described Rakowski as a supporter of dialogue and democratic reform, two goals the government says it has been trying to reach through negotiations with the outlawed Solidarity movement. In a short acceptance speech, Rakowski said he was not the demigod who was needed at the head of Poland's government. However, he vowed to build on the confidence parliament members have shown in him. Stefan Bratkowski, a leading Polish journalist, commented today that if the new prime minister chooses competent ministers for his cabinet, Poles may begin to believe he is committed to real changes. But if he settles for less, Bratkowski warns, students who return to Polish campuses next week might strike to show their own and their whole society's dissatisfaction. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of two Mexican-American bands that had a heavy influence on post-punk bands like the Flesh Tones, Joe King Carrasco, and Elvis Costello.
Oh, somebody help me!
We're hardly surprised when we think about the contributions Mexican-Americans have made to rock and roll, and figures like Richie Valens from East L.A. or Freddie Fender from South Texas come into the conversation. But there are two other Mexican-American groups you almost never hear people talk about. Neither of them is from a place that's a Hispanic stronghold, and, well, both of them are a little goofy. Take Domingo Zamudio, for instance. He was born in Dallas, but he became famous in Memphis, where he put his famous band together and recorded a song called Haunted House, which did okay locally. Then MGM Records signed them in 1965, and their first record sold 3 million copies.
Uno, dos, one, two, tres, cuatro.
It was an unforgettable record, and once people got a look at Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, as Zamudio called his band, they didn't forget them either. The group draped themselves out in phony Egyptian clothes and rode around in their hearse from show to show, thanks to the fact that one of the guys in the band had been an undertaker. Like I said, goofy. And Zamudio didn't care. It was clear from the beginning that he loved the joke, and for a while the public did, too. They made his next record, Little Red Riding Hood, a smash.
Oh!
That I see walking in these woods. Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
The band was getting better and the songs were getting funnier, but the problem is novelty groups seem to have a built-in burnout. Still, I just have to introduce you to Greenwich Grendel.
I know a chick, Grendel is her name. She's got a not a sight way out of range. She's got a mind like an IBM. But chances of loving her are mighty slim. She's Greenwich Grendel, the village queen. A rock and roll and beat the dream. She's so far out. She's in.
By 1967, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs were over, and their cleverest novelty yet only got to 54 on the charts.
Oh, that's bad!
No, that's good.
It was a Shaggy Dog record to beat them all, and I still laugh at it, even though I know how it turns out. But while Sam the Sham was in decline, up in the Saginaw Valley of Michigan, 21-year-old Rudy Martinez was on his way up with his band, a bunch of young kids who were part of Michigan's large migrant worker population. In fact, it was their organist, 15-year-old Frank Rodriguez, who made this band instantly famous. Listen to this.
Teardrops for one heart to carry on. You're way on top now. Since you left me, you're always laughing.
down at me.
Named after a particularly trashy 50s sci-fi flick, Question Mark and the Mysterians were simply bringing a sound that was very popular in central Mexico to the United States and giving it English lyrics. The cheesy Vox Jaguar organ replaced the accordion in a lot of Mexican popular music around this time, and all the Mysterians did was to play rock and roll instead of cumbias.
Hey!
It was simple. Question Mark, preferred being the Rolling Stones to being Los Tigres del Norte. But once again, the public was looking for more sophisticated things, just as the Mysterians were getting going. With their record company, the same one that had launched Chubby Checker, feeding them bad material to record, they disappeared. Today, Domingo Zamudio still lives in Memphis and was considering a Pharaoh's reunion when he found Jesus and decided not to. Question Mark and the Mysterians did reunite, but Rudy didn't want to make it permanent because he had a heavy metal band he wanted to put together. They left their mark, both of them, and moved on.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Too many teardrops for one heart to carry on. You're gonna cry 96 tears. You're gonna cry. You're gonna cry, 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 cry now. You're gonna cry, 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 cry. 96 tears. Come on, let me hear you cry now. 96 tears.
This is Fresh Air. Writer Eric Kraft chronicled the personal history, adventures, experiences, and observations of his alter ego Peter LeRoy in a series of 8 short comic novels. Kraft began publishing his stories about Peter LeRoy in a newsletter he sent to friends. The newsletter expanded into a series of books. Kraft promised his readers they could always look forward to a new installment. In Kraft's new book, Herb and Lorna, Peter LeRoy tells the story of his grandparents and their secret occupation.
This is the moment in the book when Peter LeRoy, the narrator, first discovers that his grandparents have been the originators of the animated erotic jewelry business in America. It happens at his grandmother's funeral. Sitting in a pew at the church, half attending to the service, I began to consider my new knowledge. You can imagine how it affected me. It shook me. Not only had I never known anything about this interest of my grandparents, but the whole notion was so far removed from my idea of them, their personalities, their interests, their talents, as I supposed I understood them, that I couldn't even imagine where it might fit. Eroticism, I realized with some embarrassment, had never played an important part in my mind's eye's version of my grandparents' lives. How I had misjudged them. I had belittled them, diminished their lives in a way that I wouldn't have wanted mine diminished. Eroticism certainly played an important part in my life. How could I have been so thick-headed and arrogant as to ignore the likelihood that it was as important, or to judge from the evidence they'd supplied me, even more important in theirs? I was ashamed of myself. I was also flabbergasted. I was struck with a suddenness and force that felt like a physical blow by the realization that even now I was wrong in my understanding of them. It was as if my grandmother had, in her posthumous letter, introduced me to two people I had never met before. People who had been hiding inside my grandparents. People with genitalia. Who were these people? Why did my grandmother want me to meet them?
How did the character of Peter LeRoy first appear to you?
More than 25 years ago, on a cold winter day, while I was supposed to be studying a German lesson at Harvard,
In the middle of class?
No.
Oh, at home while you were studying?
In the library. Uh-huh. In the library.
Library. Was it an idea, an apparition? What exactly came to you?
It was a dream. This was a technique.
You were sleeping in the library.
I had fallen asleep over Ich bin nun endlich in München und sitze hier in meinem Zimmer and so on that I was supposed to be memorizing. And when I awoke, I was in an embarrassing situation, an embarrassing position. I was lying on the floor and people were laughing around me and so on. I gathered up my books and beat a retreat from the library. And when I got outside in the cold air, I realized that I had a remnant of a little dream left in my mind. I had been dreaming about a warm summer day and a small boy sitting on a dock dabbling his feet in the water. And over the next 25 years, that little boy became Peter LeRoy.
Explain a little bit about the erotic sideline that you've given to the grandparents in your book.
Well, Lorna is an ivory carver in the town of Chicolet, New York, and she is trained by her uncle Luther to carve ivory for cufflinks and shirt studs and so on. She doesn't know until she becomes an adolescent and Luther initiates her into this dark side of the industry that there is an under-the-counter business in erotic jewelry for men. At about the same time, Herb, who is born into a family in Boston that is totally broke, a family of super salesmen who, over the course of several generations, have managed to lose everything that they've ever made from their talent, is introduced by his uncle, Ben, into the selling side of the same industry.
Now, when Herb starts making the erotic jewelry, he has a cover, and his cover is selling books, mostly business-oriented self-help books. Explain how he uses this as a cover.
Well, his uncle, Ben, introduces him to the notion of selling books on what sounds awfully like the prototype of the Book of the Month Club plan. He persuades a person to subscribe to an entire set of books, Professor Clapp's 5-foot shelf of indispensable information for modern times. And the gimmick is that he gets his prospective client to sign up for the first of the books, but that another book keeps arriving every month, and Herb comes back to sell, among other things, even a 5-foot shelf. But at some point in the pitch, he will take the man of the house aside, go out onto the porch or outside, and find a way to introduce his pitch for erotic jewelry, shoot his cuffs or something, and display an outstanding pair of ivory cufflinks that the fellow can't resist.
In the middle of Herb and Lorna, you have a series of photographs that are supposed to be photographs of Herb and Lorna, and they're pictured at work, they're pictured pleasing their customers, pictures of their satisfied customers. Why did you want to put in phony pictures in the middle of the book? It is a great device in your standard memoir to have the pictures right in the center there of the person who's telling the story and their family and friends.
Right. It was partly for verisimilitude, to make the book look more like a biography. But it was also because the original notion I had had of telling Herb and Lorna's story was that I wanted to tell the story of two people who were unremarkable in every way except for this lifelong love that they had felt for each other and the way in which it had brought them through life in spite of all the things that went wrong in their lives, all the things that turned against them here and there. And along the way, as I was working on the book, they came up with this remarkable avocation, the erotic jewelry, but still, my thinking about them, my conception of them as people who are really quite ordinary except for this magnificent love, made me think early on of including photographs that showed them as almost indistinguishable. You'll notice that the photograph of Herb behind the lines in the First World War identifies him with an arrow as a person whose face is not visible.
Hmm. Do you document your own life as well as the lives of your recurring characters?
Yes. My wife and I take a photograph every day and keep these photographs in an album.
Now, why do you do that?
Well, to document the small events that vanish. You know, most people, and we certainly did this, take photographs of big family events, graduations, weddings, that sort of thing. But I think that what your life is more the sum total of the smaller things that happen to you, the things that happen from day to day that really are the way that most of your time is passed and not those big events.
From what I know about you, it seems you've always had a day job from which you've earned your living, and then you've used the evenings or weekends or perhaps early mornings to write your fiction. Is that still the case?
Still the case. More often early morning now than evening, but I write and edit textbooks throughout most of the day and spend the early morning hours living with my characters.
What kind of textbooks do you write?
Textbooks in grammar and composition.
Do you get pleasure from it?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I even sneak in references to my fiction now and then.
Oh, like how?
Well, often I'm called upon to provide example paragraphs that kids will either be asked to emulate or to read and answer questions about. And so sometimes I sneak in paragraphs about the history of Babington, where most of the action of my books takes place, or paragraphs of conversation between characters. I like to think that I'm training a whole generation of high school students to read my later works.
How close do you feel to the character in your books, Peter LeRoy? When you remember his life, do you feel like you're remembering your own?
Actually, I feel very much as if I'm remembering his. And I say that because so much time has passed. I've been thinking about him and the whole constellation of people around him for so long that it is almost no longer the case that I feel as if I'm making this up. I feel as if I'm remembering it. This guy has been my imaginary pal for so long now that I seem to know him at least as well as I know myself.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Eric Kraft's new book, Herb and Lorna, is published by Crown. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories do you have planned?
Well, we're following the campaign today. Jim Angle out with Vice President Bush, who has a savings proposal trying to encourage Americans to save. Linda Wertheimer covering the Dukakis campaign. We'll also talk with Jackie Leiden in Seoul, Korea, about the talk of the Olympic Games, which is the gold medal that was taken away from Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson after anabolic steroids were found in his system. A talk with reporter Jackson Deal of the Washington Post about Poland's new prime minister, Mieczysław Rakowski. Not too long ago was a very favorably viewed liberal editor, then a member of the Jaruzelski team, and now he runs the government.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In his novels Strega and Flood, Andrew Vox took his readers on a tour of the lurid sex centers of Manhattan. Their guide was Burke, a vigilante hero who championed the cause of abused children drawn into the sex trades. Burke returns in Andrew Vox's new novel, Bluebell. John Leonard has this review.
The detective novels of Andrew Vox are not for delicate stomachs. Bluebell is his third, after Flood and Strega. Each is named for an astonishing woman. Each is set in a New York City sewer, an underground so sordid that solid citizens don't even want to hear about it. Each, because Vox himself is a juvenile justice lawyer, and his detective Burke, an orphan who did as much hard time in foster homes as he did in penitentiaries, in some way deals with child abuse, child pornography, or child prostitution. And each is savage. It's as if Vox knew more and forgave less than other novelists of the city's cesspool. It's also as if, to get fancy about it, the original sin for Vox was Stavrogin's in The Possessed, the rape of a child, after which there's no more innocence. I'm not so foolish to rank him, or anybody else, with Dostoevsky, but a Vox novel runs on rage, and many people die of it, and it shadows even the sex, too much so in Bluebell. Which sex is less often about love than it is a form of propitiation and retribution? Please don't hurt me. I will hurt you. The Bell in Bluebell is a child of incest, grown up huge and flat-faced and impossibly needy in a strip joint near LaGuardia Airport. She will assist Burke in his investigation of a series of murders of child prostitutes on the streets of the city. These children are lured to a ghost van, and the lucky ones are shot to death. The others end up in snuff movies bankrolled by the mafia. Bell will also meet Burke's underworld friends, the Mongolian deaf-mute Max, a martial arts expert, the antisocial and Nazi-hating Mole, an electronics genius, Dr. Pablo, the Harvard Med School Puerto Rican terrorist, and McGowan, the cop who saves teenage runaways, and Michelle, the transsexual, and Mama Wong, and the legless prophet. These friends are, of course, Burke's adopted outlaw family, each an orphan of his own history, looking for a safe house, talking in code and signs. Their contempt for the solid citizen is as ferocious as their loyalty to one another. In the world they live in the freak pipeline under the city, people steal babies, the white babies they sell, the others they cut up in chop shops for spare parts in the hospital transplant racket, a kidney, a liver, or a heart. "Rescue me," says Bell to Burke, who listens on his tape deck only to the blues. You want to know what Burke is really like? He explained himself best in the earlier novel, Flood. Quote, "Once I had a teenage girl come to my office and offer to pay me some money to find her real parents. She said she was adopted. It made me sick. These folks adopted her, paid the bills, took the weight, carried the load for her all her life, and now she wanted to find her real parents, the ones who dumped her into a social services agency and sold her to the highest bidder. Real parents. A dog can have puppies. That doesn't make it a mother. I took her $2,500 and told her to come back in a month, when I gave her the birth certificate of a woman who had died from an overdose of heroin 2 years before the girl was born." Burke, in other words, is the avenging father of all lost children.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Andrew Vox's new novel, Bluebell. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I speak with composer Scott Johnson about his soundtrack for the new film Patty Hearst. Johnson's instrumentation juxtaposes elegiac string quartets with driving guitar to create what director Paul Schrader called a schizophrenic sense of unease. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of the cast recording of She Loves Me, a musical that starred the Broadway diva Barbara Cook. And our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg sets some poems to music and sings them, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.